This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of today's show, building healthy neighborhoods by increasing access to healthy foods. Sue Balcom joins us for a discussion on community gardens. But first, it's March, and if you're thinking back to your New Year's resolutions, and maybe you are not meeting them, and year after year, losing weight is near or at the top of the list for New Year's resolutions. And our next guest, Meg Pennington, who joins us by phone from Montreal, says that we should rethink the way that we talk about diets and perhaps encourage us to have good diets versus going on a diet. Meg, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Meg, you call yourself a holistic nutritionist. So Set us up with a definition of that, because you studied to become a dietitian. So what would the difference be?
Yeah, so when I studied to become a dietitian, that's a university degree. It's 4 years. You have to do an internship with clinical dietetics. And so it's very based on assessment and clinical nutrition. So a lot of numbers, a lot of calculations, calories, fats, macronutrients. And so what ended up being not so resonant with me in that is that I was finding in working in clinical dietetics that people weren't really getting results. If we wanted them to lose weight and put them on a calorie restricted diet, it wasn't really working, or it would be temporary and not long term. And so what I ended up going through actually in my studies was this negative transformation of going from a fairly healthy individual to actually becoming very stressed and very food obsessed. Mm-hmm. And I gained weight and I developed nutrition issues. And that was while I was learning how to be a dietitian. So something right off the bat wasn't really right there. And when I graduated and started working, I actually first went on this big trip for 4 months, and I threw everything I had learned out of the window because it just wasn't working for me. And that's when everything actually shifted back to normal, and I lost that weight easily, and my skin issues resolved, and my digestive issues resolved. And I was like, so something wasn't right there. And so I worked as a dietitian for a few years, but I gradually stepped into a more holistic approach and kind of dropped that clinical perspective because it just wasn't working for people. And that's kind of why I'm here. What I'm here to talk about today is because there's many, many people that don't realize how they might be actually making themselves sick. And so this approach that's very clinical doesn't work for everybody. And I really want everyone to know how they can do it in a funner, more easier and more effective way.
Well, one of the things that you focus on, instead of all that criteria that you just mentioned, is food sensitivity and how our body is actually reacting to the food that we eat. And I think it's important to start out with, there are things that might be happening in our bodies that we don't even connect to what we're eating, like headaches or chronic inflammation. And we may just say, well, that's just who I am, or part of getting older. What are some of the more common ailments that we have that might be connected to what we're eating?
So the list is actually endless, but the most common would include headaches, like you mentioned, also migraines, skin issues. So that would be eczema, psoriasis, even acne. Any kind of autoimmune condition is really related to food because it's something that comes from the outside into our body constantly. So our immune system has all of its fingers in that, and it's really monitoring this all the time. And so food plays a huge role in any kind of immune system related or inflammation related condition. So that includes even diabetes, cancer, heart disease. All of our modern diseases, if you look into the science, actually have an underlying root of inflammation that's involved there. So, and the immune system is what perpetuates inflammation and creates that for our own good. But if it's a chronic thing that's happening in reaction to food, then that's where it becomes detrimental to the body. So there was headaches, skin issues, autoimmune issues, also digestive issues. So these immune chemicals that get released when we're reacting to foods, they cause different physiological effects, such as constricting or dilating our smooth muscle. So our digestive tract is smooth muscle. Our vessels, our blood vessels are smooth muscle. So all of these can contract or dilate and create issues and pains and cramps and various different things. It can cause brain fog if you're reacting to food. It can cause lethargy or tiredness. Body pain is another big one. So fibromyalgia or even just aches and pains, arthritis, all of these have to do with inflammation. And so all of them are contributed to by, if not caused by, food reactions. So it gets really, really interesting when you start to look into this.
Are there certain foods that just top the list of culprits here for causing these issues?
Yes. So I've tested hundreds of people, and generally everyone, first of all, has some sensitivity. So I've never tested someone and had them turn up with zero reactions. The question is really how far has it gone, and how much is it impacting our body and how much are we feeling it? So, but the most common ones tend to be what's in and hidden in all of our food. So dairy, gluten in wheat, corn, eggs, and soy are another. Those are like the top five that I see consistently turn up, not always, but frequently. And then the remaining can literally be anything. Our immune system, all that has to happen is if you have a piece of apple, for example, get through the digestive lining undigested, and the immune system doesn't recognize it as a big chunk of apple, then it becomes sensitized to that. And every time you eat apple, you are causing a reaction. It thinks it's an invader. And so it can literally be cashews or apples or strawberries or kale or these like really amazing superfoods that we think of as healthy. You could be reacting to those. And there's really no limit to what you could be reacting to. Even supplements, probiotics. Yeah.
So how do you find out what you might be sensitive to? Do you just have to eat only one thing and see how your body reacts?
That's the long and hard way of doing it. There are some very strict elimination diets that can do that, and it's a reintroduction process. This is generally not recommended because it's very difficult on the system. It's not nutritionally balanced. It's difficult to sustain. It's really not fun either. So the approach that I like to take is to just test your blood, so the immune cells, for the foods that they're reacting to. It's much faster. You don't have to go through such a long and difficult process of eliminating a bunch of things that may or may not be reactive. And so it's a much safer and more effective way of doing it that doesn't involve complete elimination of all food and then reintroducing it slowly.
So that's the mediator release test? Is that what you're doing?
That's right.
Okay. And how does that work?
So it's a blood test that basically the lab will partition your blood sample into 170 different divisions, so let's say vials, and they'll introduce a food antigen or a particle to each one. And so apple might be the first one, strawberries is the second one, and how the immune cells react. So basically if they explode, releasing all of their contents and their mediators when the food is introduced, that would be a very big reaction. Or if it's a small, just some messengers released, that would be considered a normal reaction. It's just the immune system communicating with the rest of the body. So in that way, we have a very scaled view of what's happening when each food is added to the system or the blood, basically, and how the immune system reacts. So we see if it's a normal reaction or a negative reaction and to what extent.
Could just the matter of how the food was processed be impacting those test results? Let's say you are growing your own wheat and making your own flour. There might still be a few people like that who do that, and you don't have a reaction to it. But making bread with store-bought flour or eating store-bought bread might cause the reaction. So is the test sensitive enough to distinguish or can you distinguish between that?
Yeah, so what generally what will happen is what the lab looks at or what they test for is an organic version and raw version of the food. So if they're testing wheat, they're gonna try whole wheat. It's gonna be an organic wheat, and they're gonna keep it as clean as possible. So you might test safe to wheat, for example, but then yeah, you could see in real life that if you try certain types of wheat that maybe have some fillers or have been bleached or have been processed in some way, they are no longer safe. And so it becomes an experimental process at some point too, because we get as much information as we can from the test results, but then there's real life factors that cannot be tested. And so there's some fiddling and tweaking that needs to be done as well.
How can people get this test? It's around $700 to $900, right?
It's $700, yeah. So it needs to be purchased through a practitioner. Like, for example, I'm a practitioner. It's they're called a certified elite practitioner. So if someone wanted to find someone in their area, you would Google certified elite practitioner in your area. Or often we do by distance as well. So it's very easy to ship someone a kit, the blood kit, and to do the consultations over phone. That works really well. And so it's very easy to find somebody. There's over 1,000 practitioners in North America. Mm. So it's, so you just order through a certified LEAP practitioner.
This might be a little outside your scope as a LEAP practitioner, but do you know of any sort of grant or scholarship or funding opportunities for, you know, $700? It reminds me of this relationship where healthy food is what tends to cost more at the grocery store. And so it's easy to fall into that trap of eating cheaper and unhealthier food. And, I wonder about this relationship too. We're having access to knowing what might be affecting you is available only to a certain social class.
Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, for sure, like I don't know of any, I've never heard of the lab offering any kind of scholarship or even payment plans, but the practitioners, like for example, I offer a payment plan. If someone has trouble paying for it all at once, then we can break it up into a 6-month plan, for example. So I try and help as much as possible in that way. There's also alternatives. So when you speak with a practitioner, if the test is really something that's not doable at that moment, then there are other ways of trying out kind of what you're eating, finding patterns by keeping a food journal, looking at what the quality of the food you're eating is. And there's often red flags that turn up even without doing a test that we can modify and address even before knowing, you know, specifically what foods are triggering the immune system. So there's lots that can be done through stress reduction and cleaning up the diet and removing chemicals and preservatives and focusing on fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds and some healthy animal fats. So there's a lot that can be done even without the testing.
We're visiting with Meg Pennington of MP Holistic Nutrition. Meg, what happens if we ignore these symptoms? If bread is making us chronically inflamed and we just keep eating bread because we don't know it, can it wear out over time, our reaction?
Yeah, so wear out is a good word because the immune system will start to subdue the reaction. So whereas someone who isn't reacting to anything all of a sudden starts reacting to something, they might actually see a very big response, like an allergy. If someone has an allergy to peanuts, it's a very big and obvious response. Whereas these other food sensitivities that seem to develop over time and are not as obvious, they tend to be a delayed reaction or dose dependent. So sometimes you might feel really okay after eating a certain food, and then other times it depends what you've eaten before that and with that tend to make it a more of a problem. And so it starts to get really tricky, and over time it tends to get worse. So food sensitivities develop because of maybe a stress in the environment or some toxins, or the gut gets permeable for whatever reason, and these foods start getting through. And then generally it tends to kind of proliferate, and it tends to get worse very slowly but surely over time. And so in your 20s, everything seemed good. And then in your 30s, meh. And then by the time you're in your 40s, there's a whole laundry list of symptoms going on. And that's generally when people start to come to see me.
You know, I started this conversation, Meg, talking about weight loss and how focusing on food sensitivity issues versus dieting might help with that weight loss. But I wonder, should weight loss really be the first thing that we consider when we're looking at overall health?
No, I would. My personal opinion is no. And the reason for that is that weight is implicated in so many factors. So, or it has so many contributing factors. So, I mean, stress, for example, is a huge contributor to weight. And so it isn't necessarily a diet that we want to look at for losing weight. Often we want to look at the other factors in our lives that are contributing to this weight gain or this inability to lose weight. So food sensitivities play a big part. Stress plays a big part. Emotional issues play a big part. Whether you're happy at your job or whether you're happy in your relationships or not play a huge part. So there's so many different factors. And weight is really just one of those symptoms of something else. And so it's not the best indicator. You can actually lose a bunch of weight with those same things, like food sensitivities can make you lose a bunch of weight. Stress can make people lose a bunch of weight. So it's really not a good indicator. It's really personal. And so there are other ways of kind of indicating or gauging how healthy you are that would be more important, in my opinion, than weight, and a little bit less unclear.
You mentioned that when you first started your journey as a dietitian, you gained a bunch of weight, and then you went on this backpacking journey, and your skin cleared up, you lost that weight. Did you find in your own health journey then that your struggles were, like you said, could be related to stress, could be related to what you're eating? Was it some of each, or was it more heavily in one?
It was definitely stress. So when I went to university, I had moved across the country. I didn't have my support network anymore. I was on my own for the first time, and university was very difficult. And it was long, and they really packed everything in, and it was very stressful. They created that way to weed out the people who are weak, I think. That was my impression. And so it was very much attributed to stress. However, what it also did was the program that I was in, being a dietetics program, it was teaching me at that time how to really focus on food. Like, food became my life. I became food obsessed. And so that didn't help either, because I started to really develop a poor relationship with food and diet and my body also. And so that didn't help at all. So there was stress, but there was also, even though I was doing everything right in terms of calories and nutrients and the types of foods I was eating, I was not seeing good results. I was actually getting worse and worse and worse. And so the stress and the food obsession, always worrying about what I was eating and if it was going to make me gain another pound, like it was horrible. And so I would say it was the two factors. It was not nutrition, because I was nutritionally balanced, but it was really the negative aspects of that, the food obsession and the stress that came along with it, that really put my body into an alarm state. And in that alarm state, your body will not lose weight. It will hang on to everything for dear life. That's what it's designed to do.
Sounds like if you stress out about what kind of gas you put in your car, but don't pay at all attention to rotating your tires or getting an oil change.
Yes.
Meg Pennington is a holistic nutritionist. She joined us on the phone from Montreal. Meg, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Coming up next, a Plains Folk essay from Tom Ezern.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Human beings are joke tellers. We take great satisfaction making people laugh and have warm feelings for those who think we are funny. But what makes a joke work, and why can only some people tell them? Are there subjects we shouldn't joke about? And is it true that humor is dangerous? Join me and my guest Al Genie as we ask these questions and hopefully laugh a bit while we do.
That's this Sunday at 5 Central, 4 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Door-to-door salesmen aren't common anymore, but there was a time when they were, selling everything from snake oil to encyclopedias. In this week's Plains Folk essay, Tom Ezern keeps up his recent illuminating theme with lightning rods and dollar signs.
The past few weeks, I've been telling you stories about lightning rods and lightning rod men, who had a shady reputation in the late 1800s and early 1900s. At the same time, there was the emergence of respectable science, affirming the protective merit of lightning rods and advising people how best to deploy them. Eventually, farmers bought in, and most every farm exhibited spikes and cables. How did this happen? Begin with an understanding why country editors were so antagonistic to lightning rod men. These salesmen came from out of town, representing distant companies. They neither cut local dealers in on the action nor purchased advertising in newspapers. They rented rooms and rigs, but otherwise were seen as an economic drain on the community. That changed when lightning rod companies sensed the demise of the direct market and linked up with local dealers, various chaps in town who had mechanical skills, such as Andrew Norberg of Bobells, who in 1906 announced that, as an addendum to his bicycle sales and repair business, he had become an agent for Dodd and Struthers' famous copper cable lightning rods. He bought a display ad in the Bobells Tribune, announcing his agency and his possession of a certificate, saying he was thoroughly schooled in the science of putting up lightning rods. And then the advertising swelled. Some was sober, even historical, such as the ad in the Bismarck Tribune, 1909, listing facts about lightning and the lightning rod, asserting, falsely, the invention of the device by Ben Franklin in 1763, and noting the installation of protective rods on both the Washington Monument and the Statue of Liberty. Other advertisers appealed to logic and prudency, as did Thompson Hardware in the Washburn Leader in 1909. "You may never have lost a barn," Thompson warned, "but your neighbor did." That same year, Hope Implement Company, pitching its Shin's Copper Cable Lightning Rod, asked, "Why take chances?" and offered the assurance of the Shin Guarantee. An ad in the Ward County Independent in 1909 went so far as to assert that lightning rods were free, inasmuch as the reduction in insurance rates for properties fitted with protection would repay the cost of installation. Purchase of advertising turned country editors from antagonism to boosterism. A newsy item in the Griggs County Courier-Democrat in 1909 urged readers to take in a demonstration by Dodd and Struthers at the fairgrounds. This item ran two columns over from a large display ad purchased by Plummer and McNiven, local agents for Dodd and Struthers. My favorite example of such promotion, the note in the Dickinson Press of the 17th of July, 1915, reporting, "The sisters and their patients in St. Joseph's Hospital are feeling much safer since the place was equipped with the Dodd system of lightning rods. J.W. Molloy, local agent, did the work." And on the same page, find the paid announcement. "J.W. Molloy has taken the agency for the Dodd and Struthers lightning rods. This system is the best in the United States, and the local agent will be glad to give anyone estimates on equipping any building against lightning." Lest the point be obscure, this notice in the Nonpartisan Leader, 26th of April, 1920. "Lightning rods. Big profits, quick sales to live dealers selling Diddy's Universal Rods. Get our agency." Which actually is the last paragraph, because it's one sentence. Submitted for your consideration. Historically, as in contemporary life, it may appear righteous and efficacious to claim public authority, grounded in morals or science or whatever. But in time, under attentive observation, the dollar signs will be discernible on the palimpsest.
Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, Sue Balcom joins us for a discussion on community gardens, and we have our What's Happening calendar of events and a Natural North Dakota essay. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. With spring break approaching, University of North Dakota students are getting an education about COVID-19 awareness. UND spokesman David Dodd says administrators are meeting almost daily, monitoring the ever-evolving situation regarding the virus that causes coronavirus. Dodd says UND has issued messages to students, faculty, and staff with suggested guidelines.
We've gotten information out, best practices on what they should be doing, washing their hands, and being mindful of where they are traveling in the world and when they're coming back. And at this point, we're looking at the CDC guidelines.
The North Dakota University System is recommending that all campus-sanctioned overseas travel be suspended until further notice. Chancellor Mark Hagerot also said schools should consider asking students currently overseas in overseas programs to come home and asking students to limit overseas travel during spring break, which begins March 16th. UND has set up a coronavirus blog on its website to provide updates. County auditors and election officials are in Bismarck for the biennial election conference. The conference includes equipment training and election security. The state has a new voting system, but North Dakota Secretary of State Al Jager says voters will not notice any changes in how they cast their ballots. He says so far things are going smoothly with training on the new system.
I've said it many years with this group. Our goal is that the day after the election, all the news will be about the results and not about the process. And we've been very successful with that over the years.
Cass County Auditor Mike Montplaisir says the county bought enough of the machines handicapped people can use, and he says that will help, especially in the early voting precincts.
Before, we have to have so many of each ballot style, and we have over 100 ballot styles. And this will, you know, alleviate that problem. If we happen to run out of a ballot style, people could still vote.
Jager says the new electronic poll books will arrive before the June primary, giving the election officials time to get used to them. And Xcel Energy will pay a $12,000 fine for a natural gas leak that led to an explosion and fire at a Fargo senior living complex. That fire happened January 4th, 2019 at Riverview Place. It damaged four of the 24 apartments. No one was hurt, but the building was evacuated for several hours. North Dakota Public Service Commission Chairman Brian Crosius.
The gas was leaking. Again, wasn't vented properly. It did make its way into a mechanical room. There was combustion within that mechanical room. Could have been an incredibly serious situation and led to not only injury but death at the same time.
Crosius says, in addition, some of the natural gas pipes were not adequately protected from corrosion. He says the utility has acknowledged the problem and has installed updates. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. We might be seeing mid-50s in western North Dakota this weekend, and snow is already melting across the state. Time to add more color back into the landscape, though it has been there if you are looking in the right places. Here's Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota.
With the big white blanket of snow covering the ground and the trees bare, except for the conifers, the landscape is lacking in color. But there are still a few fruits from last summer persisting on some plants. And the fruits I've been noticing most frequently in the Turtle Mountains are highbush cranberry. Calling this plant highbush cranberry, however, is a misnomer. It's not a true cranberry. The closest wild cranberries are probably up in the forests of Canada and northern Minnesota. They belong to the genus Vaccinium and are in a heath family, which in addition to cranberries includes blueberries and rhododendron. But the fruits of highbush cranberry are tart and red, so the association with cranberries is understandable. Highbush cranberry is a shrub that grows to roughly 5 to 10 feet tall and produces a candelabra-like cluster of bright red berries, about the same size as choke cherries, that droop from the ends of small light gray to brown branches. As you might expect, rough grouse, turkeys, waxwings, squirrels, and many other species of wildlife utilize the fruits, but they seem to persist into the winter more than many others. That might be a function of their sugar content. These fruits are not sugar bombs. Like choke cherries, they're quite astringent. And also like choke cherries, tasty jams and jellies can be made from the fruits, of course, with the addition of copious amounts of sugar. Highbush cranberry may be found in the woodlands from British Columbia to Quebec, south to Iowa and Pennsylvania. Here in North Dakota, it's found north and east of the Missouri River, and is perhaps the most common in the Turtle Mountains and Pembina Hills. Botanists now recognize the species as Viburnum opulus variety Americanum, an American variety of the European highbush cranberry. Not long ago, the scientific name was Viburnum trilobum, a separate species and a reference to the distinctively three-lobed leaves, which is an easily recognized characteristic used in identification. Highbush cranberry produces showy white flowers, bright red fruits, and attractive foliage, which makes it an interesting horticultural shrub. So you might want to consider it as an ornamental. We've put a picture of highbush cranberry along with the text of this natural North Dakota. You can access it at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lehrer.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Next time on The Pulse, it was just a commercial for a hotel chain set to a sappy song showing moments of joy.
There's a dog tackling his owner when he arrives home. There's a room full of school kids hugging their teacher.
But every time Andrea Ford watched this, she got really sad.
They're not even real people, it's acting.
Why does sadness sometimes hit us like that? We'll take a look on The Pulse.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and in our Bismarck studio, our dear friend Sue Balcom. It's time for another episode of Main Street Eats. Sue, thanks for joining us.
I am happy to be here.
And, you know, it's that time of year where I'm walking to work and I'm sliding on ice the whole way and I'm walking home and I'm walking through puddles most of the way. There's been a little bit of a thaw and you start to see some grass peeking out.
The birds are back. The geese are squawking in droves. The deer are mating. The moose are pooping. It's all good, man.
And it's time to start thinking about gardening.
Absolutely. This is my absolute favorite time of the year. A, I was born in the month of March. And B,
happy birthday.
Thank you. People born in the spring have a tendency to be a little bit schizophrenic, which would explain all of these things that I like to do, starting with gardening. And now's the time to think about gardening. People have many excuses not to garden. They think that it's hard work. They don't see anything beneficial about eating 5 servings of fruits and vegetables daily. But then there are those people who absolutely can't garden and would love to. And that's where community gardens come in.
And community gardens are, for anyone who's not familiar,
they are little plots of land that you can reserve. Let's say you live in an apartment complex and your landlord doesn't want you putting a tomato plant in his flower bed. There are designated areas, and I'm not sure of where all of them are in the state of North Dakota, but there are 4 in Bismarck. There are 6 in Fargo that are part of this really super good program that I'd like to just put in a plug for in a minute. There's 1 in Oneida, which is a tiny little town, 1 in Cheyenne, 1 in Grand Forks. I think Minot might have some. And Mandan has one that I was an integral part of starting probably about 10 or so years ago.
Oh, thank you for that. So are they plots that people are buying and tending to their own, or is it typically more like anybody can use the land but be respectful and then share the harvest and there's no money exchange, or is it?
Nope, it's actually kind of a little more organized than that because most of these lands are public lands. And so your best bet would be to kind of get a hold of an extension agent or someone at the park district and see if there isn't a piece of property not currently being used for sporting events and or parks. And maybe they would be willing to help you determine where there's a good spot for a community garden. And then somebody has to handle what we call a contract. And I know that's a terrible thing to say in the same sentence with the word garden, but you have to have accountability with a community garden. The plots are designated. You are renting a plot. The one in Mandan is like $25 for a 20 by 20 foot plot. It's tilled by the Extension Service, so you don't have to worry about tilling, so you don't have to buy any equipment. There's usually a water supply or water source there for you to use. You just need to abide by a few rules like what you can and cannot plant, whether you can use chemicals or not use chemicals. Do you have to bring your own hoses and or tools, or do they have a place that you have like community tools? So there are a few things that you need to know about community gardens, but it is so much fun.
What kinds of things might end up on the cannot plant list?
Well, you don't want to plant something like rhubarb because that's a perennial.
Okay.
And therefore, it would get tilled under every year. You know, because the whole plot has to be tilled under, and then somebody goes out and squares it off for the people who are gardening in there. There might be rules against flowers. There's certainly going to be rules against things that pollinate themselves from year to year that could end up being a noxious weed, in somebody else's opinion, in their plot, because they're right next to each other, and you have to be really respectful of your neighbors.
Yeah, well, that kind of brings up a topic. There can be a little bit of a contentious debate about even just dandelions. Sometimes these are weeds, and they use every measure they can get their hands on to get rid of them. And then other people make tea. They know that they're good for soil health and for bees. And
definitely for bees. That is one of the biggest things that has to be decided. And most of the people who garden are pretty much against the use of excessive chemicals. So you would have to actually maybe ask that the park district be a little bit respectful about not spraying near the community garden. And then as far as planting dandelions, I don't think anybody deliberately grows dandelion patches. Although I have seen some community garden plots that kind of look like that by the end of the year.
Because my yard.
People don't go in and tend their gardens. And also, one of the things that, you know, community garden does not mean that it's a free-for-all that anybody who walks by can help themselves. But there is that theft issue there. So we always had like a little rule about approaching anybody that you did not know in a community garden when you were out there working in your plot and saying, hey, hi, I'm, you know, plot number 64 over here. Who are you? To find out if they're actually supposed to be there or not.
Oh, okay.
You know, that is a big thing. However, then that would bring me to the Nola Storm and Jack Wood growing together gardens, of which there are six in Fargo. And I admire those two for doing what they do, because they've started these garden projects for the new American population in the Fargo area. And they work tirelessly with these people in these gardens. They're huge. They're usually on a church property or some other, you know, nonprofit area of town. And they go in and they work with these people on planting these gardens. Everybody has to come on work days. They actually have potlucks in the field. And then everybody shares the produce. And it is a wonderful way to integrate these people into our community. And it's a wonderful way to get to know some people and maybe try some new vegetable varieties that we're not familiar with in the Great White North.
You know, you mentioned working with the park district that maybe they don't spray for dandelions or what have you near that plot. But what about aerial spraying from mosquitoes?
Boy, now you're talking about something I am not familiar with, because on the west side of the river, it's usually too dry for mosquitoes, and we do not spray. Now, I don't know. Is that toxic to plants? Apparently not, because there's people all over Fargo that have gardens, correct?
Yeah.
And the day I thought about doing this community garden thing, I did see a Facebook post. Whitney Oxendale, she worked worked with the city to create a list of safe spaces to plant gardens in the Fargo-Moorhead area. So there's an online resource now that actually encourages people to go out and garden, which is considered a lifetime sport, I think, isn't it? Something that you do forever that gets you bending down and doing downward doggy dives into the weeds.
I teach yoga for gardening class every spring.
What a brilliant idea. Oh, my gosh. I'm going to have to steal that from you, I think.
All right. Works for me. I'll teach you yoga for gardening, and you give me your produce.
Oh, that sounds like a good trade-off. But yeah, community gardens are just really super, super, super good for any community. And look at all these small towns that have empty lots.
Yeah.
You know, what you want to do, of course, is investigate what's been on that lot. You know, you don't want to plant a garden on a spot where they might have been dumping
nuclear waste.
Right, or something from a, So, right. Some kind of chemicals, any kind of chemicals like that.
Sure.
But there are plenty of places to plant. And in fact, planting a garden over a green area saves a lot of work on a lawn. Why would you mow a lawn when you could grow a garden, for crying out loud? It's important that we all feed ourselves, too.
Do you know, so you've mentioned these resources that are great for identifying land that's already available. What about if someone knows of land that would be a good candidate for establishing a community garden? Do you know that process?
What you would do, or what you could do, is go to see your local extension person. Go to the person who owns the land and ask if it's okay if you dig it up. Then I think if you put something out on the bulletin board at your local restaurant or local church and say, hey, we're planning a community garden, have a meeting and see if there's interest in the first place. Then you want to check to see whether you have somewhere to get water from. So the key would be a good piece of property, lots of sunlight, willing participants, and, of course, being able to get water there. The first year at the Mandan Garden, which is near the soccer fields and the rodeo grounds, we had to bring in a great big huge water tank that wasn't being used. And so the fire department would come and fill the water tank.
Oh, wow.
And then it was a gravity fed. And so you got lots of exercise walking back and forth with your buckets. Finally, my husband, this is how I got my husband to dig the first garden out at our house. He didn't want to have to drive to town and water when I was at work. And so he's finally like, okay, you win. We're digging up some dirt. And now we're, you know, building another high tunnel, and we dug another garden. And I am just so excited because it's springtime. I can't wait to get out there in the dirt.
Well, I will join you. Sue, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ashley. It was my pleasure.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that is a question we ask ourselves here on Main Street on Thursdays. And joining me to answer that question is Christine McClellan. Christine, thanks for joining us.
Hello, of course.
And all what's right. on your list?
So tonight, actually, there is the 5th annual NDSU Press Party. That's going to be at the Alumni Center at NDSU in Fargo. NDSU Press authors will be sharing from their 6 most recent publications. The event is free and features live music, hot and cold hors d'oeuvres, their signature book covers, cake, a cash bar, and all book sales on site will be 25% off tonight. So that's tonight, 7 to 9 p.m. Again, that is free at the Alumni Center.
Well, I'm in, say, in Watford City because I really just want to say this word. Spring!
Yay!
Spring Fest 2020, March 7th at the Rough Rider Center. You can come and celebrate spring. There's going to be carnival games, prizes, a bounce house for kids, a vendor show, raffle drawings, cash prizes. Saturday, when, you know, some of the parts of the western half of the state could see even the mid 50s.
50 degrees,
yeah,
I know.
And hopefully they're sending it right on
our
over
way,
to the
yeah.
east side of the state. So celebrate Spring Fest in Watford City, March 7th at the Rough Rider Center, Saturday 11 to 5, and it's just $5. And that includes 10 tickets that you can use at the festival.
The Performing Arts Series is presenting the Thalia String Quartet. This is Saturday, March 7th at the Gaty Stage at MSUM in Moorhead. The Thalia String Quartet is dedicated to bringing timeless music to audiences from all walks of life. So that's Saturday at 7:30 p.m. Tickets range from $6 to $28.
Okay, I know I just got done talking about a spring fest, but we're also doing polar plunges because spring, well, that's what spring is like. Yes. It can be hot or cold, and they're going to go for the cold in Dickinson on the 7th at the Prairie Hills Mall. This is a polar plunge that is an annual fundraiser organized by law enforcement and some community volunteers. They are raising awareness as well and support for the Special Olympics North Dakota. You can jump into the cold water starting at 12:30, but at least the outdoor temperatures might be
it might not be that polar outside the mall.
Costumes are encouraged, by the way. Saturday from 11 to 1:30 in Dickinson at the Prairie Hills Mall for the Dickinson Polar Plunge.
The classical musicians John Bruce Yeh and Patrick Godin are performing Sunday, March 8th in Grand Forks and Monday, March 9th in Mayville. John Bruce Yeh is a clarinetist from the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and Patrick Godin is a native of Fargo, North Dakota, and he holds a Bachelor of Music and Master of Music degrees in piano performance from DePaul University. So they are going to perform Sunday at 2 p.m. in Grand Forks at the North Dakota Museum of Art, and Monday at 7:30 p.m. at Mayville State University. And tickets for this is $15 to $35.
And John Bruce Yeh is Molly Yeh's dad.
Father,
we've
I know.
We've had her on the show many times, and of course she has her own show on the Food Network, Girl Meets Farm. So tonight on television, 7 o'clock Central on Prairie Public, Mr. Rogers, It's You I Like is going to be showing. This is celebrating 50 years of this series. Fred Rogers, to me, one of the greatest men who has ever lived, and the work that he did educating and loving children. And you can celebrate this tonight on TV at 7 o'clock on any Prairie Public station.
Yes. All right. The Minot Symphony Orchestra is hosting a fun and games concert on Saturday, March 7th at the Ann Nicole Nelson Hall at Minot State University. You can dress up as your favorite video game character and come listen to the music of some famous video games performed live by the Minot Symphony Orchestra, as well as Gershwin's famous Rhapsody in Blue, featuring Minot State's own Sean Bostrom. They'll perform themes from well-known video games, including Civilization VI, Assassin's Creed, Syndicate, The Banner Saga, Lara Croft, Journey, and more. They're also hosting a cosplay contest, so they're serious about dressing up as your favorite character to this concert. So it's Saturday, starts at 6:30 p.m. Tickets range from $10 to $30, and this is for kids and family-friendly.
Now that sounds like a fun combination of events that I would not have thought to put those groups of
people
together. I know,
orchestra and cosplay, but
yeah,
it works.
It's a great idea. All right, my pick of the week is Seussabration, maybe Seussbration. I can make up words. He made up a lot of words. This is a celebration of Dr. Seuss in Williston on the 7th at the library. Come dressed up as your favorite Dr. Seuss character. Dr. Seuss, in addition with Mr. Rogers, one of my favorites in history. Saturday, 2 to 3 p.m. at the Williston Community Library.
All right, my pick of the week is International Women's Day. So come and celebrate women at the Dakota Medical Foundation in Fargo on Sunday, March 8th, which is International Women's Day. It's a global day celebrating the social and economic progress made toward human rights and gender equality. While this event has occurred internationally for over 100 years, this is actually the inaugural International Women's Day for Fargo. So there will be some guest speakers. They have Nikema Levy-Armstrong from Minneapolis, Katie Dochtler from Grand Forks, Tracy Wilkie from Fargo, and Asia McKeer from South Sudan. So this is Sunday, 4 to 7 p.m., and they will accept free will donations at the door.
That's what's happening.
Support is provided by North Dakota United, an organization of over 11,000 education and public employees serving the public every step of the way. Information available at ndunited.org.
Hello, teachers. I'm Tim Wollenzien, Education Services Manager at Prairie Public, inviting you to our weekly web chat series. This free professional development video series features area educators sharing resources, ideas, tips, and tricks to help you maximize your teaching power. No need to travel for inspiration. Get convenient, flexible PD from your home or classroom. Continuing education credit is available. Learn more at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 5th. It was on this date, in 1980, that Congress authorized the construction of the North Country National Scenic Trail, a 4,600-mile trail from Middlebury in central Vermont to Lake Sacagawea State Park in central North Dakota. In between, it passes through New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. Today marks the 40th anniversary since Congress approved this national gift. Long before the trail was ever thought of, people were intrigued by the idea of long-distance hiking. In the early 1900s, Benton McKay conceived the idea of the Appalachian Trail. But it wasn't until the environmental movement in the 60s that Congress, in 1968, passed the National Trail System Act, which approved the construction of the Appalachian and Pacific Crest Trails. The act also called for the study of 14 other possible long-distance trails, including the North Country Trail. In 1971, a combined state and federal task force began researching the best routes for the trail. It was overseen by David Shonk and later Bob Martin from Ann Arbor, Michigan. In 1973, a young and recently graduated Tom Gilbert started supporting the project by developing materials for public meetings in the states the trail would cross. Gilbert became the first superintendent of the trail. He continued this work until 2011 when he retired. The trail continues to develop, and as of 2015, there were 2,880 completed miles. It's estimated that volunteers contributed over $1.5 million worth of labor. 191 miles of the route are in North Dakota. 80 of those follow roads, while 111 are off-road. It starts on the eastern edge of North Dakota by Fort Abercrombie and then passes through Walcott. After that, it crosses the Cheyenne grasslands, where hikers can enjoy a North Dakota countryside of pastures, cows, and grain silos. After that, it follows the Cheyenne River, winding by attractions like Fort Ransom State Park and Lake Ashtabula. The final stretch is mostly on roads, but permission is being sought to route the trail through the Audubon National Wildlife Refuge, the Wolf Creek Wildlife Management Area, the city of Riverdale, and across the Garrison Dam. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
You can purchase a book of Dakota Datebooks at shopprairiepublic.org.
After a disappointing finish on Super Tuesday, Elizabeth Warren has ended her bid to become the next president. The Massachusetts senator drew big crowds and loyal supporters, but that didn't lead to victory at the polls.
I really like Elizabeth Warren, but I just don't think a woman is going to win this election, unfortunately. Also, I don't want Trump to, like, tear her down.
A look back at her campaign on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, in an increasingly global world, governments need to be coordinated in attempts to deal with viruses, much like the coronavirus threat of recent weeks. We learn about public health interventions. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.